to be frank, you have to say there's a demonstrated lack of understanding about the political system. People want to be told how to vote in many instances. Mm. They look for it. Even people that have been voting for 20 or 30 years will say, how do I vote? What do I do? What's the difference between the Senate and the House of Reps? Very, very big deal. And we weren't equipped to do it with all of that sort of stuff. We spent millions of dollars, of course, getting our message out, which no one listened to. That's the reality of it.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Australian Politics Live. I'm Catherine Murphy, political editor of Guardian Australia, and I'm also the host of this show. My guest in the studio this week is Corey Bernardi. Now, I was very keen to have this chat. I wanted to bring him back into the studio. Now, he's announced that he is folding the Australian Conservatives Party, and he's sitting at the moment in the Senate as an independent. I just wanted to unpack the story of what it was like from his perspective attempting to establish a new political party in Australia at a time of disruption and change. And it really is a really interesting conversation. Listen up. Well, Corey, thanks for coming on the show.
You're most welcome. Thanks for having me.
Now, funnily enough, we had a conversation immediately after your decision to break away from the Libs and set up Australian Conservatives. That was in 2017. And you told me in that conversation that breaking away, doing your own bizzo, would be the most difficult path you could have chosen. Were you right?
I was absolutely right. It was very difficult, you know, personally, because I'd left a party that I'd been associated with for a very long time. But also starting something from scratch, and it really got a bit out of control for a while with the workload and the stress that was attached to it. It was a really tough thing. I think it was probably the toughest thing I've done, even in a business sense, because the pressure was constant and relentless.
Mm. You said you'd lose sleep, you'd lose friends.
Yeah. Well, you find out. Well, what you do is you find out who your true friends are,
mm-hmm.
because a lot of people are interested in the transaction here in Canberra, but even I was surprised by some people in Adelaide, for example, people that I'd known for a very long time, sort of just went the whole ghost routine because you weren't part of their tribe anymore.
Mm.
It's quite interesting. It gives you an insight into people's character, but having said that, the friendships that are maintained, irrespective of the politics, have been very, very genuine, which is fantastic. So it gives you an insight into people's characters as well.
Who your actual friends are.
Yeah, and, you know, I understand it perfectly. There's no ill will, but what's interesting is to see the change back. You know, these people who have, I use the term ghosted you for 2 years, suddenly want to become back into your circle again, and you can't treat them the same.
Well, why?
It's just weird. I literally, there is, people identify themselves by this political tribe. I mean, the left do it, the right do it, a whole bunch of stuff. And if you're not with them, you're against them. But it also says to me about politics, it becomes an all-consuming thing. And so I can understand how people find it hard to let go. I can understand how their personal relationships disappear or diminish from those that aren't involved in politics. But if you become that one-dimensional political character, you lose so much else of your life. And when you leave politics, there's nothing.
Mm.
It's empty. Mm. And, you know, I swore to myself I would never let that happen. So I've maintained a friendship circle outside of politics. But, I'm so glad I did.
And the other thing you said to me was that it was the right thing to do.
Yeah, I look back on this, and because, you know, we've dissolved the Australian Conservatives, and I reflect on it. You know, could I have done things differently? Of course you could. But I do think it was the right thing to do, because as difficult as it was, there had to be an alternative. The Liberal Party was heading off a cliff, and I think their supporters were deserting them. And the simple fact that we had 22,000 odd members within 6 months of starting is really demonstrative of that.
Mm.
The minute Malcolm Turnbull left, we started to lose members.
Well, this is, yeah. This
yeah, we started to, our polling numbers, you know, internal tracking went down. Our reason for being diminished. And then I stuck with it, I guess. I'm not going to say I stuck with it, but the kind of expectation was Liberals would lose, they would tear themselves to bits, and maybe there would be a split on the cards. I'm grateful that didn't happen, to be honest.
It's really fascinating you say, because obviously your decision to leave the Liberal Party was in the context of an alienation you had from Turnbull. I don't want to personalise this because you actually don't personalise these things, but that was some of the context. I mean, there were big things happening at the time you set up Australian Conservatives. There was this sort of disruption and disaffection very live in the electorate. There was your feeling of alienation from, let's say, Turnbull's model of liberalism or what the Liberal Party was. That was sort of all the backdrop to it.
It's a bit more than that, though,
yeah,
Catherine.
Well, tell me.
The disenchantment of how politics was heading was, it started before that.
It wasn't just the rolling
of Tony Abbott. Even the decisions that Tony Abbott made in office, I thought, my goodness, what are you doing? Why are you abandoning, you know, some of these things that were meant to cherish? The decision to put taxes up, for example, and standing up in the party room and saying, we know this won't make any difference, but it's a nice signal to send. You know, that sort of stuff is just... it's not the stuff that the Liberal Party should be doing.
Yeah.
So there was that disaffection, but then it did culminate in the fact that the party room itself decided to roll a sitting Prime Minister and commit the same sins from a political sense as the Labor Party did, and it thought the outcome would be somewhat different. Then, of course, Malcolm comes in, and I found Malcolm quite respectful, to be honest, personally, but he comes in, leads us to a terrible election disaster where they lost a whole bunch of seats, even though they, you know, Pine and co said they're in the winners circle. The real losers were the Liberals again, and they thought there was no plan to reclaim that ground that was being ceded to One Nation and later on some others. And I remember saying to Malcolm at the time that this is unhealthy. What are you going to do? How are you going to give them an alternative? How are you going to get these voters back? There was no plan, and I thought rather than give up and abandon, you know, that disaffected Liberal vote to people who I don't think were particularly good for the country, I thought I'd try and fill it. And, you know, what you think you can do and what you can actually achieve are often at odds.
Well, sure. And, you know, good on you for self-deprecation. But do you think among your supporters, even if in your mind this was a bigger enterprise than just, you know, giving the middle digit to Malcolm Turnbull, right? And I know for you it was a bigger enterprise, right?
It was.
But I absolutely accept that. Ryan, but for your supporters, for the people who departed from the Libs and joined Australian Conservatives, do you think in their mind it was the middle digit to Malcolm?
There was a lot of the middle digit to Malcolm and expressing unhappiness with it. There was also those who were attracted to us because they knew my liberal values, and we were a party that was determined not to have, you know, the factionalism and the entrenched, you know, gerrymanders that go on within particularly the New South Wales division of the Liberal Party. So we had a lot of people that were disaffected from that. A lot of people who'd never been a member of a political party before. I remember being so proud of the fact that some chap wrote to me from a nursing home, first time he's joined, you know, a political party. He was 100 years old. And he said, I want to hang around until there's a Bernardi prime ministership. I mean, there's an optimist for you. And then at the other end of the spectrum, we had people that were 12 or 13 that were joining the party. And, you know, that's really encouraging stuff. Mm-hmm. But they just realised there had to be something different in politics. And for good or for bad, I've always called it as I see it, and that resonates with a group of people. But ultimately, our reason for being, it was clear as day, when they changed leader, our reason for being, according to many of our supporters, changed
as
well.
You mean when the party changed to Morrison?
Yeah, I beg your pardon. When they got rid of Malcolm and changed to Scott Morrison, he reclaimed a lot of the ground that we'd done, that we'd tilled the soil for. There was a very clear move back to them, and I still thought they wouldn't win the election. Because, you know, the polls. How many polls can be wrong?
Well, exactly. We all thought that.
And that was despite the fact that a lot of people told me they couldn't vote for a shortened government. It was just a very interesting sort of synopsis, I guess, about this convergence of factors, if I can put it like that.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, during the election campaign, I kept saying, I don't know how this is going to play out. I just can't get a grip on it. I couldn't get a grasp. I knew we were spinning our wheels a little bit. But I still had no idea how it was going to end up.
But you had people, didn't you, during the election, say your own people, your Australian Conservative members and stuff, saying we're going to vote Liberal, even though...
Yeah, well, this is part of the frustration, right, that we had a huge database. And coincidentally, you know, we got a lot of the people that are on our database. It kind of matches the numbers of voters we had around the country, pretty much. Mm. But we communicated to these people that we were going to run in the Senate, only in the Senate, because we didn't want to be a threat to whom they wanted to choose for their government.
Yeah.
Because we knew there were a lot of Labor people, that traditional Labor people that liked the conservative, socially conservative message that we were pushing. There were a lot of traditional Liberals who liked us. And so the minute you engage in the battle between who are you preferencing of these two, you end up a loser.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know how many times I spoke about that. We ran it. We communicated messages and everything. After the election, of course, we received thousands of emails from people saying, oh, I didn't want XYZ to get in, so I voted Liberal first, or and then you guys. And you just say, which part of our message didn't you understand?
Yes.
And so it was very frustrating, but there was, I'm sure that was a huge factor for a lot of people. And you'll see the minor party vote was actually diminished quite a lot across the board.
And also... you've said in terms of the positioning of Australian Conservatives, right, that you were a sort of, well, I suppose a more mainstream right-wing party, because obviously we've been through the last parliament where One Nation has, you know, sort of returned to the national stage, where we had the whole Fraser Anning period. Now, you and I had some scraps during that period.
You were right, Murfaroo.
Well, I'm
right,
not...
Now, take that off. Delete that off this podcast.
No, well, exactly. That is an extraordinary thing for you to say, Corey Bernardi. But no, and I don't want to retail personal conversations, but it's. But I want you to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah.
Right, because we had sort of One Nation, very strident sort of stuff. We had Fraser Anning, who has views that I don't want to promulgate or repeat or give any oxygen to, frankly, in that last term. And you couldn't quite work out, I don't think, where to position yourself there. Or why am I telling your story?
No,
You tell your story.
Unashamedly, we wanted to position ourselves as a mainstream centre-right party. We wanted to adopt the values that I thought the Liberal Party had abandoned. And we did that. We fought, you know, we were fighting for families and lower taxes and civil society, all of these traditional Liberal spaces.
Yeah.
Our policy agenda, whether you agree with it or not, was considered, it was principled, and it was consistent. We could articulate all of it. Now, all the things that I've complained about other minor parties, and I would say this about One Nation, they're just completely inconsistent about from one day to the next.
Yeah.
I can't rely on what I'm told when I'm having discussions with them in cases. It was the same with Darren Hinch. You know, Darren Hinch would sit there saying, in the Medivac legislation, for example, where we were saying, you know, you're failing the character test. You can allow pedophiles in or people accused of domestic violence or sexual abuse. You can allow them in under this. And he just didn't want to hear about it, you know, because it was inconvenient. So we tried to position ourselves into that space, and we would work cooperatively with whomever. And that includes, on occasions, the Greens. You know, I think a Royal Commission to the Murray-Darling Basin is important, actually. And so I supported that. I worked with Labor. I worked with One Nation on occasions. And I worked with Fraser Anning. But with Fraser, when he came in, there was a marked change in Fraser. I mean, in the end, he made a determination for himself, and I think he kept chasing the publicity that comes. And this is a trap for a lot of people in politics. They make something happens to them, and they get attention from the gallery or, you know, get in the headlines in the paper, good or bad. It triggers something in you, an emotional response. You get lots of emails that people say you're doing the right thing and a whole bunch of people telling you you're a goose.
Yeah.
And then the temptation is to chase that. It's like chasing crack or crystal
or
meth or
Gollum,
whatever it is.
Gollum with the ring
with
or whatever.
Ring, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't, just for the record, I'm not into crystal meth or crack or Gollum. But it's a drug. It's an attention drug. And I think a lot of people who get fame on their 15 minutes of fame crave that. And so I saw that change happen in Fraser, like I've seen in others. And unless you temper it, you spiral, you end up in a very dark place.
But you ended up sort of having, well, you didn't articulate the sorts of extreme positions that he was beginning to articulate. I'm not pinning that on you. You didn't do that, but you also didn't really disassociate yourself
In the end, there were because I believe people are entitled to their views, right? And I would say to Fraser, for example, about his immigration plebiscite on immigration, I go, you know, it's all good in theory, mate, but what question are you going to ask the Australian people? You know, you're going to ask them for, should immigration be higher or lower? How many migrants? What should be the composition? You'll get 16 million different answers. Mm. I mean, it's a nonsensical proposition to put because it's not practical.
Yeah.
But I had to work. We had to, with David Lyon-Hill and Fraser and myself, we used to meet once a week to talk about what we had in common, particular motions, because you need second voices for motions and things like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm not breaching any confidences to say that towards that process, we saw this change in attitude about Fraser and some of the things, and we couldn't support a lot of the things that he put forward.
Mm.
And we explained it to him. You know, your wording is clumsy. You're, what you're trying to achieve is not going to be there, you know, but we couldn't help.
Do you think that when you, with Australian Conservatives, because this was always, I thought, and we spoke about it in our first conversation, this was always going to be a challenge for Australian Conservatives because you weren't first movers, right? One Nation were already in the domain and there were other players around. So always a bit difficult to carve out that territory unless the Liberal Party was not moving to a full split, which you referenced right earlier in the conversation, which we both agree seemed likely at one point, right?
Yeah.
Because of the sort of the wets and the right wingers being unable to have much common ground, right? It looked like it was.
I'm glad you call them wets. That's what I call them too. Good work. Good work. I'm working on you.
You know what I mean, right? So it was always going to be a challenge for you trying to position yourself in that we're not crazy right wing space. Call it that way. Right? Just call it that way. So you might be a bit pejorative, but you know what I mean, right? We are right wing in the classical sense. We are not crazy, right?
We're not reactionary.
Yeah.
So the everything about it, and I said this to you, it was a difficult path, right? But it was presupposing success was always going to be measured on a range of things happening. And that range of things was, I thought that One Nation wouldn't hold together. Mm. Now, I was right about that, but their ability to have sticky admirers, irrespective of the facts, is extraordinary.
It is extraordinary.
And, you know, I found that, for example, you know, a couple of times I took Pauline to task on, you know, policy positions which are inconsistent or you know, Port Arthur conspiracies or whatever it is, and the abuse that I would get from these people all over Australia saying, you know, why are you picking on Pauline? She went to jail for us. And I would respond and say, I'm not. I'm highlighting the inanity of this policy position and how inconsistent it is, but that you couldn't reason or logic or have a logical discussion with that. So there was that sort of stickiness that comes from 20 years of battling the system, and full marks to her resilience, you know, for sticking
out. I don't mean to cut you off. Do you think that the stickiness of her supporters is 20 years of sticking it to the man, for want of a better word, or, I mean, I'm sort of dancing around this point, but I'm just going to ask you directly, right? Anning, Pauline, they play race politics. That's
what they look, do. This is. I'll get to this if I can.
Yeah,
I just want to go around a bit longer way. So there was that stickiness of that vote that liked the sticking it to the man. I've called them the angry voter, and I don't say that in a disassociative way. It is just people who think the system sucks so badly, they don't care what vehicle they use to attack the system. And so she has the brand. I mean, Pauline Hanson is a well-known name. One Nation is the sort of name that rolls off the tongue. Doesn't matter anything else. It's my form of rebellion.
Yeah.
Like, you know, some of us used to be hippies, or, you know, today you can be a conservative, or, you know, in the voting public, you cheer on Pauline Hanson. Then there is the extreme nationalist sort of race-based orientation as well. And that appeals to a certain section of the community. And those people are not healthy for us, because on the right side of politics at all, because their racism, you know, their anti-Semitism, their They're anti people on the basis of their skin colour. It's not a logical, rational discussion about Islam or the threats of that. That's, I think, equally dangerous. But this was part of what I've been talking about for 15 years, is that if you don't deal with the issues that people are concerned about in a rational and reasonable manner, it gives rise to these equal and opposite reactions, which are dangerous.
But this is the thing. See, this is where our little live social experiment has landed us, though, in a way, right? You created a political shopfront where you played in that space, in that petri dish, for want of a better word, but you didn't play the extreme nationalism, isolationism, racist.
I think it's wrong.
Yeah, I know. I know you think it's wrong. But the point is, you tried it and it didn't work.
Yep.
So what are we to conclude from that?
Ah, well, that this is actually pretty tough. What I concluded is that, you know, I should dissolve the party.
Mm.
That's the reality of it, that there is always going to be a group of people who are unhappy and are motivated by that anger or unhappiness, and they point it in a particular direction. And I think you've got to put a stop to that. You've got to stop it rising, is how I would appeal to it. It hurts me deeply that Fraser Anning got more votes than us in a number of electorates, simply for espousing stuff which I think is really not valid in contemporary Australia. But the voters make their decisions, don't they?
Well, this is the thing.
So you're always going to have this. I mean, look, you know, on the left, you've got some kooky left. You've got on the right.
Sure,
you've got a bunch of people who are motivated by single issues. I mean, I call them the stoners, but, you know, the hemp party got more votes than us.
Well, Animal Justice did really well.
They did. And, you know, they spent none of the time or the money or the effort or energy, but this is part of the democracy.
Oh, yeah. Look, I'm sorry. I'm not standing here at the railing at the microphone about people being able to vote for whomever they want. I'm just, what I'm trying to get to in this conversation is, I sort of feel privileged. I had the first conversation with you at the start, right, where we've landed. What have we learned? And we've learned that you trying to pitch a tent in this space, it hasn't worked.
Well, it hasn't worked. And the thing was, we were too sensible for a lot of people who want the system to be detonated and blown up. And our space was, quite frankly, retaken by Scott Morrison. I mean, if you just think of the demographics that we have, that the people of faith, there were a lot of those out there in the faith community who were concerned about that and what, you know, Malcolm Turnbull's sort of dithering in that
secularism
space. Yeah. So, and there's a reasonable cohort of those. There's a reasonable group of people who think that, you know, government has been too big. You know, there's the pro-family people that are there. So we tried to gather those together, right, in many respects.
Mm.
But then what happens is Scott Morrison comes in. He's seen as the family guy, and quite rightly so. You know, the daggy dad mantra. Everyone's been called a daggy dad. And every father has been by someone. So that, you know, identified him with people. He likes footy and eating pies. He's, you know, not too slim. He's not too fat. He's a person of faith. He's seen to be a reasonable bloke. All of those things play into it, and it gave people confidence to go back. Then, to be frank, you have to say there's a demonstrated lack of understanding about the political system. People want to be told how to vote in many instances.
Mm.
They look for it. Even people that have been voting for 20 or 30 years will say, how do I vote? What do I do? What's the difference between the Senate and the House of Reps? Very, very big deal. And we weren't equipped to do it with all of that sort of stuff. We spent millions of dollars, of course, getting our message out, which no one listened to. That's the reality of it. And Clive Palmer. Who would have predicted Clive Palmer? I mean, 60 million for 3.5%. I'm feeling good about myself.
No, that's right. Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, your return on investment is better.
Yeah, but it's still pretty bad. But, it's extraordinary in these contexts. And, I'm not going to argue with the electorate. They're right. But you just – and I don't resolve from the fact that I did what I did for good reasons, and maybe, just maybe, it did – shepherd the Liberal Party in a slightly different direction, because you cannot hemorrhage 10 or 15 or 20,000 of your supporters to another political party and not go, hey, maybe something's wrong.
What about the combination? We've sort of dealt with you and the nationalists, let's call them that. Yeah. Let's be polite and call them nationalists. What about you and people of faith? Because obviously you absorbed the Family First operation. Now, you're a Catholic, you know, like me, old school religions. Yeah. We're not Pentecostal people, but the Family First operation, there'd be a lot of Pentecostal people involved in that. So how was that?
Well, this, you know, in the end, I'm not sure that it worked for us again. Family First approached us because they clearly thought that their brand was struggling in the marketplace after what had happened with Bob Day and various other things. They also had few resources. They had some good people, but very few resources and very little structure to their party. You know, their party was just a bunch of names, really. They didn't have membership fees and things like that. So, and I thought, well, that will give us a bit of momentum. There'll be a couple of members in the South Australian Parliament whom, you know, I've had some respect for. And I thought, you know, it would be a positive. But what it actually did do is it gave, it set some expectations, I guess, for momentum and things of that nature, which I was very keen on. But it also, in the minds of a lot of people, just said, this is a religious party.
Right.
And I went to great lengths to say it's not. I am a person of faith. I make no bones about it. And I'm the most flawed individual, you know, that my wife knows anyway. But I think it's important in the sphere. But I'm not one of those evangelical Christians. Mm. I don't argue my position from a biblical perspective. I'm, you know, not having prayer circles beforehand and before political meetings or something. You know, I'll give you one example. We had someone handing out how to vote cards apparently in Geelong, I think. I stand corrected on that. But and they wrote to me saying it was so good handing out how to vote cards because then I could talk to people about the Bible. And, you know, that's not what people go to a voting booth to do. And so that overt religious intonation is really actually counterproductive in politics, to be honest.
Mm.
I think people respect faith, they respect the values and the framework that it gives, but you know, you're not meant to be out there proselytizing in the public square.
Couple of things. So you've folded Australian Conservatives.
Yep.
You've got a bunch of data, though, about people and information about people. What are you going to do with it?
Well, I'm really concerned about people's privacy, to be honest. You know, most of the data that we've had, most of the people on our communication list have grown out of my weekly blog and my podcast that goes out every week now.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's been in the over 100,000 for whatever. We've built it up over 10 years. So we continue to do that. People can opt out and opt in. What I've had lots of overtures of people saying, oh, I want to start a political party, you know, drive your members towards me or give me your lists or whatever. And I'm not interested in that. I think that's wrong. It's just ethically wrong, even if it's allowed by law.
But would you? Well, I assume it is allowed by law, which is why I'm asking.
From a political point of view, because political parties can do whatever they
like.
Well,
you're exempted from the Privacy Act, so they can do it. That's why I'm asking you the question. So, what will you do with that information?
I have no plans about to do anything with the information, to be honest. I think I regard people's privacies as very important. You know, there's publicly available information. I think we've got 5 million telephone numbers.
Mm.
You know, I might send them all a text message, say g'day.
Well, as you're walking out the door, what are your plans? What are you doing?
Well, there's a few things I want to get done in Parliament. And it's interesting how accommodative so many people have been. Maybe they want to see the back of me. So we'll tick these boxes for him and move him on.
Surely not.
Well, there's a few things. Look, I really do think we have to have a conversation about nuclear energy in this country. And that's gathering a bit of momentum. I think the freedoms issue is a big one. And I don't have the answer to it, but I do. Well, I've got a protected freedoms bill going to the Parliament in the next week, which is basically, in every piece of legislation, it asks the government to explain how this is going to impact upon people's freedom of speech or freedom of association, freedom of religion, what consequences are, just like we do with asking them to explain how it's going to compromise people's human rights.
Yeah.
And so there's a bit of clarity to that. I think it's a rather elegant solution to a very, very difficult problem to prescribe what your freedoms
but
are.
You want to hang around while the Libs resolve this? Is this what you mean?
I'd like to. I think there's an opportunity to get these sensible measures through in this Parliament. And then there's an issue with commercial fishermen, which is a niche issue, but it arose because fishing is very important to South Australia, and the tuna fishers, who need no help in the monetary sense, but they agreed to give up some of their quota on a temporary basis in order to, you know, make it easier for the government, I think, to on the international stage. Then the government only gave them back half of it and fell for the pea and thimble trick and gave half to the recreational fishers. And so I thought, hang on, these people have paid a lot of money for the for this quota, this commercial right to fish. And how is it the government can just unilaterally take it away without any sort of reference or compensation? And so I'm working on a solution to that, because it is, I think it would it would encourage more investment in our fishing industry, which I think is right. It's world class already, but I don't want to see it corporatized. I want to see it, you know, remain that the individual commercial fisherman, I think, needs to be given a shot, and they can't borrow money against their quota often because banks won't lend on it because of the uncertainty. So I've got a solution which I think the government can wear because it won't cost them any money. It just will hold them to account in case they make dumb decisions.
Right. Okay. So, interesting. So, well, it sounds like we'll see you to the end of the year.
Yeah, probably. I mean, maybe they'll cave in on all my demands straight away and then say, on your way. Yeah, I've said, when I started in this business, it was 2006, right? So I'm an old hand at it now. But my term was meant to expire in 2020. And all of, you know, I'm one of these forward planners. You think, if this happens and this happens and this happens, you know, this will be the end result. And I always planned that June 2020, I'd be 50, time to start another career, you know, a podcaster or something like that. The Guardian got a spot for me, have they? You know, you could be a broad church up here as well.
Yeah, well, we are a broad church here, yes, but anyway.
And maybe not that broad. And I thought, you know, there's a chance to have another career and to do something different. And we all have a finish time. So in my mind, that's where I'm working on it. It might be a bit before that. It might be a bit after that. But, you know, I'm enjoying this next chapter. It's so different being up here without the pressure of, you know, having to lobby a party room or to run a political party. It's actually quite enjoyable.
Oh, well, we might be liberated in the final chapter. Corey, thanks for coming on the show.
That's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for listening. I really do appreciate it. Thank you to Hannah Izzard for production. Thanks to all of you who subscribe and share and tell your friends about the program. We'll be back in the not too distant future with more from the National Capital.